Las Vegas, Sin City, home to dozens of casinos, over 60,000 slot machines, 15 of the largest 28 hotels in the world are on the Las Vegas Strip. You can walk down that street sipping alcohol from your paper cup. You can get married very quickly and divorced almost as quickly, and it is a mecca for adult entertainment. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, right? Well, this morning, as we've heard already, we find Paul on his missionary journey in the city of Corinth. And Corinth was sort of the Vegas, the sin city of the ancient Roman Empire. Like Vegas, it attracted tourists from all around the empire. It hosted the Isthmian Games, which were second only to the Olympics in importance in ancient Greece. And there was this massive temple for Aphrodite that stood at the top of the hill, the mountain that overlooked the city. And one commentator notes that visitors to the temple were, quote, less interested, perhaps, in the magnificent view of the Peloponnesus Mountains than in the numerous sacred prostitutes attached to the temple. In Greek theater, Corinthians were stereotyped as drunkards, and in fact, the phrase to live as a Corinthian became common to use to talk about people with sort of loose morals. You know, what happens in Corinth? Well, when Paul arrives in this city, this comes immediately on after his visit to Athens that we heard Pastor Nathan talk about last week. And he follows this pattern in Corinth that we've seen him use several times by now. He goes to the local synagogue and he begins preaching there, telling his fellow Jews about Jesus, who he understands to be the Messiah. He finds some sympathetic Jewish believers, gets a few Gentile converts also, and eventually starts a separate congregation of Jesus followers. Now, this congregation that we read about in Corinth seems to be a particularly diverse one. Our text begins with the introduction of Paul's fellow tent makers, or possibly leather workers, as our translation reads today. And These are Priscilla and Aquila have recently arrived from Rome after being cast out of the city along with all the other Jews by the emperor. And it's noteworthy when we read about this couple. They're mentioned six times in the New Testament. Four of those times, Priscilla's name comes first, which would have been unusual to have the wife's name come before the husband's. It seems to indicate that she must have been a strong personality, somebody who often takes the lead in their shared ministry, someone who is indeed specifically gifted in teaching and leading. And in fact, if you read into the next, the end of this chapter, you'll find where she seems to take the lead in talking to Apollos, the evangelist in the city of Ephesus, which was referenced in the book that Rebecca read to the children this morning. Some scholars even speculate that Priscilla might be the anonymous author of the letter to the Hebrews that we have in the New Testament. There's another member of the church that's mentioned. It's Titius Joseph. He's described as a Gentile God worshiper. Now, this is somebody who has come to worship the God of Israel, but doesn't follow the entire law of Moses. For example, he probably was not circumcised. Now, at this point in Acts, we've met several folks along the way already. Some we've heard talked about in our sermons here. Others are just mentioned in texts that we haven't talked about, but Cornelius would have been one of those, Lydia another one. These Gentile God worshippers seem to follow, have significant roles in the growth of the early church. And Titius Justus is one of those. He ends up opening his home, which is right next door to the synagogue, and becomes the meeting place for the followers of Jesus. Finally, there's another individual who's named here, and that is Crispus. Crispus is identified as a synagogue leader, the synagogue leader. Now, this is a position that would have placed him in charge of the building, sort of the physical structure, making arrangements for services that were there. Paul ends up baptizing him and his entire household. And that no doubt would have added to some of the tension that was happening already within the synagogue. And so we have this diverse, this core of the new church. We have a Jew who's recently moved to Corinth from Rome. We have his wife, who is a strong leader and teacher in her own right. We have a Gentile who's hosting the group in his home right next door to the synagogue. And we have the former leader of that synagogue itself. It's a disparate group of people who are united by their witness to life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. United in their desire to live as faithful followers of Jesus in this decidedly anti-Christian city. But ultimately, the opposition that we read about, which they face, is not what comes from the worshipers of Aphrodite up on the mountain. No, it's actually from the worshipers of God who were meeting right next door. Now, again, I've said this a number of times in this series, we need to understand this is not an indictment of Judaism in general. I mean, Aquila is identified as a Jew. Crispus, synagogue leader, obviously a Jew. Paul, clearly a Jew as well. In fact, at the very end of this text, we find him carrying out this very Jewish vow where he has his head shaved. None of them stop being Jews when they become Christians. And frankly, at this time, the time that we're reading about these events, even the time that Luke records these events for us, there's not a distinct understanding of Jews and Christians as entirely separate. At best, Christians may be understood as a certain school within Judaism, those who are following this rabbi Jesus, just as others have other teachers they follow, Hillel, Shammai being some of the more prominent ones of those. So when Paul angrily marches out of the synagogue and shakes the dust off his clothes and declares, "You are responsible for your own fates," he's not pronouncing a perpetual curse on all Jews. He's rejecting the religious establishment of that time and that place because of their refusal to accept the open and welcoming ministry of Jesus that he is proclaiming. Now the point in all of this is that the conflict we find here in Corinth is not between the people who worship the one true God and the people who worship many different gods. No, the main conflict is found within the community of faith as they meet separately in their own different buildings right next door to each other. They're reading the same Bible. They are praying to the same God. They are probably still observing the same holy days. And yet, the animosity that grows between them seems to be greater than what they feel towards even the worshipers of Aphrodite and her reported 1,000 prostitutes. Now, this conflict that we see here, beginning in Acts 18, is one that's elaborated on throughout the letters that Paul later writes to the Corinthian church. We have this collection of writings, the largest group of any writings addressed to a single group in the New Testament. 1 and 2 Corinthians, we know from reading those letters that there are probably at least four different letters that Paul writes, and scholars are divided between whether these are two of those four letters or whether these two letters contain excerpts from various ones of those letters. We're not entirely sure. But in any case, Paul's major motivation for this extended correspondence with the Corinthian comes from the arguments and the divisions that are taking place in that church. And throughout these documents, Paul is addressing a wide variety of internal conflicts there. We know that some believers claim to be followers of Paul, others of Peter, others of Apollos. Still others, some are influenced strongly by Greek philosophy, and then they're arguing with many of the Judaic members about things like the bodily resurrection of Jesus. In worship, some are disruptive as they suddenly burst into tongues. At the Lord's Supper, some are getting drunk and others are going hungry. And then there are other church leaders who seem to be coming later on and visiting Corinth and questioning Paul's credibility and his authority. Time and again, the main conflict is not between believers and unbelievers. No, it is between those who worship the same God but disagree about beliefs and practices. Luke makes it pretty clear in this passage that those who aren't part of either the synagogue or the church don't really care that much about this conflict. When a dispute is brought to the governor, Gallio, he dismisses it, saying, "Since these are squabbles about a message, names, and your own law, deal with them yourselves. I have no desire to sit in judgment over these things." And even when the current synagogue leader is beaten in front of him, Luke tells us that none of this mattered to Gallio. I mean, you know, what happens in Corinth. So all these conflicts between the believers that Paul writes about in the Corinthian church almost 2,000 years ago, conflicts over leadership, over theology, over worship styles, over class distinctions, all of those we can still find in the church today. We're divided in many ways, Catholics versus Protestants, evangelicals versus mainline, progressive versus traditionalist. We Anabaptists, well, we seem to be especially prone to division. According to Mennonite World Conference, there's a little over 450,000 Anabaptists here in the United States. We're divided into 61 different denominations, alliances, whatever. Lombard Mennonite Church has been no stranger to conflict and dissension over the years. Disagreement over things like church leadership and LGBTQ inclusion have at times led to large migrations of people away from this congregation. And so a lot of the times when you look around, we see these conflicts, our desire is to just avoid them. We've seen the damage that these disagreements can cause, so we don't want to talk about it. We want to gloss over any of the differences that we have. Maybe they'll just go away. And yes, there are times that conflicts will resolve themselves without direct intervention, but more often, avoiding often results in greater conflict than if they'd just dealt with initially. One of the things I appreciate about the New Testament is that it doesn't just gloss over all of this conflict that happens in the early church, and I find some encouragement in the fact that all these disagreements that we're facing today are nothing new. The church of the first century faced them also, and yet it still managed to grow and to thrive. And in spite of all the conflict that the church has faced throughout its history, the Christian faith is still very much alive today. In fact, one might even argue that it is actually because of all that conflict that the church is as strong as it is. I mean, if the church hadn't faced so much conflict early on, would Paul have written all these letters? About a quarter of the entire New Testament is attributed to Paul, and most of that writing consists of his responses to churches and to church leaders who are dealing with some sort of conflict. Without those disagreements, we would have been deprived a significant portion of what we now consider to be Scripture. Now, in addressing all these conflicts, one of the things that Paul writes to the church at Corinth is this. He says, God was reconciling the world to himself through Christ, not by counting people's sins against them. He has trusted us with this message of reconciliation. So we are ambassadors who represent Christ. God is negotiating with you through us. And we beg you, as Christ's representatives, be reconciled to God. Reconciliation, says Paul, is at the very heart of the gospel. And this is the good news. Through the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus, God has sought reconciliation with us. And because we are reconciled with God, we are also able to reconcile with one another. We become ambassadors of God's reconciling work, representatives of God's kingdom in our broken world. That's what the good news is all about. Now, Paul doesn't say conflict is always good, no. He's not asking us to seek out or create conflict. I think he's well aware that there's enough conflict already going on. We don't have to create more. But I think what Paul is suggesting is that we accept the fact that conflict is there and we seek reconciliation rather than avoiding it. Now, as Mennonites who emphasize peace a lot, we sometimes have difficulty acknowledging this. We fear that conflict might get out of hand. And when it does, it can lead to violence, right? But there are those who suggest that the opposite may be true. Usually we think that conflicts are what create violence. So it seems, well, if we avoid the conflict, we can avoid the escalation into violence. But the reality is, conflict's an inevitable part of life. It does not necessarily result in conflict, in violence. Rather, it is often our failure to appropriately deal with conflict that leads to the violence. Violence is what we end up resorting to when we don't deal in a healthy way with the conflict that's inevitably all around us. Now, I think this is true whether we're talking about two nations lobbing shells at one another or about a spouse abusing their partner. It's true whether we're building physical walls on the border to keep out the wrong kind of people or whether we're putting up invisible walls here to keep the wrong folks out of our church. It's true if I personally strike somebody or if I participate in an institution that is dehumanizing other people also made in the image of God. There are a lot of forms that violence can take. When we fail to work through the conflicts in our families, in our churches, in our communities, in our world. More than 30 years ago, Mennonites across Canada and the U.S. Adopted a statement on agreeing and disagreeing in love. And it encourages churches to deal with conflict without resorting to all these forms of violence that I've been referencing. The document outlines 12 steps for Christians to work through in dealing with conflict in the church. And the first of these states very bluntly, accept conflict. Acknowledge together that conflict is a normal part of our life in the church. Might seem a little negative to start with, but the next point, I think, really takes a more positive turn on it as it declares a firm hope. Affirm that as God walks with us in conflict, we can work through to growth. And I think that second point is something that the church in Corinth came to understand. They were a church with a lot of conflict and a lot of difficulties, but they were a vital congregation, a congregation that ultimately became an important tool for God's work. Because unlike Vegas, what happened in Corinth did not stay in Corinth. From Corinth, Priscilla and Aquila went to Ephesus, and they planted the church there along with Paul. From Corinth, Paul would later come and write the letter to the Romans that we have in Scripture. From Corinth, God's people went forth as ambassadors of reconciliation in the midst of an often violent world. What happens in Corinth becomes a catalyst for the growth and for the expansion of the church. What happens in Corinth still affects how we live today. Because of what happens in Corinth, we can still see how God's Spirit is at work through conflict to build up the kingdom. Because of what happens in Corinth, we know that God can use our differences and our conflict for the furthering of God's healing and hope. Because of what happens in Corinth, the redeeming and reconciling work of Christ continues to live on in our world today. All because, ultimately, what happens in Corinth does not stay in Corinth.